The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
And welcome to the Free Library of Philadelphia. I'm Siobhan Reardon, President and Director here. One of the best jobs in Philadelphia, I must say. And as I like to say, the Free Library of Philadelphia is probably the most important education and cultural institution here in Philadelphia. And it's exciting to see all of you here with us on a Friday night. Before we go any further, I want to make sure that your cell phones or anything that bings or blings or whatever is off or on a silence, and to remind you all that there'll be a book signing right after Ms. Dockett's presentation tonight. So in order to do my usual, let's talk about the Free Library for a minute. As I said, I believe it's the most important civic and cultural institution in the city. And the City of Philadelphia provides funds for our operations of our 54 neighborhood libraries and this facility, including the staff at each location. But it is through the generosity of individual gifts that the Free Library Foundation is able to support the quality of incredible programs we're able to produce, like tonight's program. It is our goal to promote literacy, guide learning, and inspire curiosity every single day we're open, and to enrich the cultural fabric of our city. So to learn more, I know as soon as you get home, you're going to go online to www.freelibrary.org and check out everything we're doing. It's a requirement, okay? So tonight, it is actually my real pleasure to introduce the fantastic Catherine, or Kitty, Stockett. Born and raised in Jackson, Mississippi, Ms. Stockett is the author of the number one New York Times bestseller, The Help, which has been... And as we all know, it's now spent nearly 100 consecutive weeks on the New York Times bestseller list. But before it became the book it is, it's really interesting to know that over 50 literary agents turned the book down as she was trying to move that along. And probably because of the story is a complex story. It examines complex relationships between white and white families and their black domestic maids in Jackson, Mississippi, in the midst of a civil rights movement in the early 1960s, and does so using the voices and experiences of both black and white women. The book is as we all know, is the story of a book within a book, and the significance of the three very powerful main characters and how they evolved and the story that they came to put together. It is a story of injustice. It's a story of people taking incredible risks. It's a story of growth. It's ultimately a story of hope. But also, it is a story of the significance of a good writer and the story of or someone wanting to be a writer and finally evolving to that point. But really, it's the significance of storytelling and the significant storytelling. And so let us bring out a wonderful writer and a fabulous storyteller. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Catherine Stockett.
Shit, Siobhan, there are a lot of people here. I thought this was going to be a very intimate group. Thank you to Andy and the Free Library. Thank you, Philadelphia, for coming out. This is so nice. This is my first time in Philly. I'm really excited to be here. It's beautiful. I went and saw that big dead bird of, whose was that? Of the Raven, you know. That was fascinating. So much history there. So let me just tell you what I know. And if you've already heard it, you just have to hear it again. Before I was born, my great, great, great Aunt Carrie hired a second cook. She was so afraid that her first cook was going to die and take all the recipes with her, she hired a woman named Dimitri. And as it ended up, Aunt Carrie died before anybody else. And was the puzzling tradition of the time was you passed the help over to the next family member. There was a very complicated system of keeping a maid taken care of their whole lives so that they were not without a job. And yet, you could also look at it like Dimitri was stuck working for our family her entire life. She worked for my grandmother for the next 32 years, from 7 in the morning until 4 o'clock in the afternoon, 6 days a week. And I didn't think this was anything out of the ordinary. Everybody in my neighborhood had an African-American woman in the kitchen doing the clothes, looking after the kids. When I was 24, I moved to New York City, and that is when I realized I had actually had a rather unique childhood compared to the rest of the world. Dimitri really went out of her way to make sure that me and my brother and my sister all felt like we were important, that we were something special. What an incredible gift to give a child. And it goes so far beyond what a paycheck can cover. When I started writing the help, I wrote it with a real abandon. I didn't think anybody was going to read it. And I gave myself a lot of liberties that I think I would not have had I known it was going to be published. As of, I don't know, about a month or two ago, the help has been translated into 39 languages. That still blows my mind. After it had been out a couple of months, I got this email. I used to post my email on my webpage. I don't do that anymore, but I got this email from this woman in Rome. Now, I live in Atlanta, Georgia, so I thought it was Rome, Georgia. But it was the real Rome. And she said that she liked the book because it made her reflect on some of their own race and class issues. And it made her realize, and me at the same time as I was reading this, just how much has changed in the world today. And I am so grateful for that. I say this all over America. We have come so far, and I know that we still have a long way to go, but I'm so proud of the United States. One of the things that I hear a lot when I go on tour, people are very forward with their opinions with me. I don't know why. Sometimes when I'm in an airport, and I'll be, you know, sitting across from someone reading the book, and they might look up and recognize me, and they'll, you know, follow me down the through the airport. And they'll tell me, you know, I really loved your book because it took me back home. Black and white people tell me that. They say, I never knew that my grandmother went through this, or I never knew that it was like that. And of course, sometimes I'll be sitting next to someone in the airport and they'll open up to page one and they'll close it again and go get a refund. And then they'll look at me and say, yeah, I just couldn't get through it. It made me too uncomfortable because I'm a white writer taking on the voice of a black person. Or maybe because they didn't want to go back to that time. And you know what? I get that. Because as I was writing this, I was really writing it because I was homesick. And I was living in my apartment downtown. And it had just, 9/11 had been like the day before. And we couldn't call our families and tell them that we were okay, that we were barricaded into our neighborhood, and they cut our phone lines. We couldn't even call my mom and say, we're fine. And I got so homesick. And it's funny, the first voice that I wanted to hear so badly was Dimitri's. But not just because our phone lines were cut, but she'd been dead for 15 years. I couldn't call her. And so I did what, you know, as a writer is the next best thing. I started writing in what I imagined and remembered her voice to be like. That was an incredible journey for me and so comforting. But there I was at 30 years old, realizing I had never asked myself the question of what was Dimitri thinking and feeling all those years. It took me about 6 months to really get there. At first, it was all about me and how I felt as, you know, the little white child. And that's really chapter one. And then it was like the top of my head opened up and this little alien popped out and said, you know what, this is bullshit. I couldn't believe it. And I was embarrassed and I was angry at myself. And yet I was really excited to try to explore this question. What was she thinking? What was her home like? I wasn't allowed to visit. I only visited it one time. And I was quickly whisked out of there and put in the car. What did her feet feel like all day? What did she do on the weekends? The rare, you know, weekend that she had off. And as I asked myself these questions, I found what for me were some answers. I have to say this. I know that I did not get it all right. And I know that as long as I live, I will never truly understand what it felt like to be a black woman in the 1960s in Mississippi working in a white person's house. But I think it's so important, just as intellectual, compassionate human beings, to try to imagine that, to wonder what it feels like to stand in someone else's shoes. And it has nothing to do with feeling sorry for someone or looking down on someone. I have an 8-year-old daughter, and I encourage her all the time. Think about what does it feel like to be the president of the United States? What do you think it would feel like to be a bus driver? What do you think it would feel like to be a school teacher? And we go on these journeys together, and it's. I just think it's so important that we all do that and we pass that exercise on to the next generation. There's a question that comes up a lot, and I do receive still emails sometimes and letters through the mail, you know, sometimes from academics and teachers, and they say, we have finally cracked the code. We know what that cover is about. That is, the two black maids standing on one side and Miss Skeeter standing on the other. Or that's the Junior League on one side and Skeeter standing or Miss Celia. I mean, the formulas are endless. But I'll tell you the story about the cover of this book. My publisher sent me an email right before we were about to go to press. And she said, would you approve this as the cover? And it was a white baby hand holding an older black hand, a black and white photograph. And it was beautiful. And I emailed her back, Amy Einhorn. I said, oh my gosh, use that. It's gorgeous. And about 30 seconds later, she sent me an email back and said, oh my God, we can't use that. People might think the book is about race. So about 50 cover selections later, trying to find the exact one that was right for the book, she finally uncovered this painting by Ellen Granter, and she emailed and said, I think I have the answer, and I said, look, Amy, I don't give a rat's ass what you put on the cover of that thing, as long as it's not purple or yellow. I'm not a fan of LSU. I went to the University of Alabama. But they chose this what I think is a very lovely picture because it has absolutely nothing to do with the book. It's a daunting subject in America. It has been for 15 or 20 years, and it still is. And I'll tell you, whether you like the book or not, I'm just so proud that people are talking about race again as a topic and as a reflection on our history. I know it's hard. It's hard. It's uncomfortable. You know, I was taught that race was not a subject a nice young lady discussed. But I find that when you put a book on the table, it makes it a much easier subject to approach. The UK, they have a totally different cover. They don't have the same hang-ups about race that we do, evidently, or at least about poking fun at the United States. My publisher over there sent me a photograph and said, would you approve this? And this time it was a photograph she'd gotten from the Library of Congress, and it was two black maids in white uniforms and a white baby in an old-fashioned stroller between them. And at the bottom of the photograph was handwritten, Port Gibson, Mississippi, 1940. And I looked at it, this old black and white photograph, and so I sent it to my friend whose mother lives in Port Gibson. And I said, Mrs. Greenlee, who is that in that picture? And she said, oh, that's Sarah Chrysler on the corner of Church Street. She had two maids because they own the local newspaper, and she was very wealthy. So I emailed it back to my UK publisher, and I said, oh, Juliet, of course you can use that picture. That's just Sarah Chrysler on the corner of Church Street. I love to perpetuate this myth that Mississippi is one small town, and we all pass each other in the grocery store every day. If you don't mind, I'm going to read one piece, and it's not really from the book. It's actually from the end. And my publisher is Jewish from New Jersey, and she said, when we were just about to go out with the story, she said, I think you better write a piece about what it's like to be a Southerner living in New York. So this is what I wrote. The rash of negative accounts about Mississippi in the movies, in the papers, on television, have made us natives a wary and defensive bunch. We are full of pride and shame, but mostly pride. Still, I got out of there. I moved to New York City when I was 24, and I learned that the first question anybody asked anybody in a town so transient as New York was, where are you from? And I'd say, Mississippi. And then I'd wait. To people that smiled and said, oh, I've heard it's beautiful down there, I'd say, my hometown is number 3 in the nation for gang-related murders. To people that said, God, you must be glad to be out of that place, I'd bristle and say, what do you know? It's beautiful down there. When a drunk man at a roof party from a rich, white, Metro North train type of town asked me where I was from, and I told him Mississippi, he sneered and said, I am so sorry. So I nailed down his foot with the stiletto portion of my shoe and spent the next 10 minutes educating him on the whereabouts of William Faulkner, Elvis Presley, B.B. King, Oprah Winfrey, James Earl Jones, and Craig Claiborne, the food critic for the New York Times. I informed him that Mississippi hosted the first heart transplant, the first lung transplant, and that the basis of the United States legal system was developed in part at the University of Mississippi. I was homesick, and I'd been waiting on somebody like him. I wasn't very genteel or ladylike, and the poor guy squirmed away and looked pretty nervous for the rest of the party. But I couldn't help it. Mississippi is like my mother. I am allowed to complain about her all I want, but God help the person that raises an ill word about her around me unless she is their mother too. We're going to go into questions if anybody has any. Before we do, though, there's just one question I'm going to ask you not to ask. It seems like every time I go tour in the South, somebody, usually a friend of my mother's, says, "Darling, are you Skeeter?" And, you know, Skeeter was not very attractive. So don't ask that, please. Thanks, Andy. Okay. Stay in the light. Is it on? Can y'all hear me? Yeah? Really? Okay. Is anybody brave to ask the first one? Yes, ma'am. Oh, wait. You have to wait for the microphone.
We're all dying to know whether you're working on another book.
Well, am I working on another one? I'm trying. I don't seem to have as much time as I used to. But I have started it, and I love writing. Just the act of sitting down and writing is so frustrating, and there's so much joy there. You know what I find? I find that if I don't write it every day or every couple of days, this is the way I think about it. My grandfather had this huge set of keys, and he kept them on a leather strap, and he would tie the strap together. And every time he'd add a key, just untie it and add it on. And then when that one got full, he just tied another strap to that one. And it was huge, and he knew where every key went on that ring. And you could always hear him coming. But when I don't write, and I let too much time pass, I feel like I am standing on the steps of my own house, and someone hands me that set of my granddaddy's keys, and it takes me, you know, days, weeks, months to try to find the right key to get back into my own house. So I've let a lot of time slip by, but the story I'm working on is once again about women and once again about Mississippi. I have a few more things to say about that place. And it takes place during the 20s and the 30s. I'm just sick. I miss the Depression. It defined so many people's lives and so many people's personalities. My grandmother literally would not fill up the bathtub with more than that much water. You conserved in every part of your life. And so these women, you know, grew up sort of privileged, and all the men in their lives die or leave them, and they have absolutely no marketable skills, these women. So they are challenged to find a way to make a living, and they're rather creative about it. I'll leave it at that. It was due in January, but, you know, I'm here with you, so. Yes?
I absolutely loved your novel. And in addition to it being about racial relations and in the 60s, I thought, I don't know if this is a question or not, but what I got from it, and I wanted to know if this is one of the messages that you put out through the book, you did say it at the end, is I'm going to read from your book. There's so much you don't know about a person. I wonder if I could have made her days a little bit easier if I'd tried, if I'd treated her a little nicer. Wasn't that the point of the book? For women to realize we are just two people. Not that much separates us. Not nearly as much as I thought. And, I mean, I got more out of, this is just me personally, not being from Mississippi, out of the relationships between kind of the women of society versus Phelan, who was kind of standing up for what she believed in. You know, I got more out of that. And just seeing that we should be more sympathetic towards one another and each other's plight. You know, probably got as much out of that as I did about the racial relationships. So obviously, was that also a theme? I I guess is my question for you and your book.
Well, I panicked when I realized, I think like my publisher, that I had written a book about race. And so that wasn't really what I was aiming for. I really wanted to write a book about the things that in our minds separate us, whether they are genuine or not. And so that's why I added in Celia Foote. She was such a dingbat, you know. And so, I'm glad. Thank you for picking up on that message, because God knows I am not here to try to teach anyone a lesson. People ask me, you know, which character are you in the book? You know, are you Skeeter? And the truth is, I think I'm a little bit of every character. Minnie, you know, Mae Mobley, Celia Foote. I mean, God knows I've made some bad fashion choices in my day. And, you know, at one time in my life, a little bit of Hilly Holbrook, too. So, we're all unique, and yet there's just not that much that separates us. I still learn that lesson every day. Thank you. I can't see. Yes. I don't know. I had to stay in the light, he said.
What was the experience that you had with the movie, and how did you internalize that?
Oh, we're going to show the trailer, right, Andy? Oh, he left. Yeah. So the trailer is going to be shown after this, and it's trailer's pretty good. The movie's good. It was. I had fun. It was. Kind of a fairy tale situation. I grew up with a guy named Tate Taylor, who is just trouble with a capital T. And I was a little bit of trouble myself, and we went to kindergarten together. We had a blast. We stole his daddy's car at 14 years old and drove to New Orleans and had dinner at Brennan's and a bottle of champagne. And we went and slapped it off in a parking lot and drove home and just took the punishment. It was worth it. And we have been making trouble together ever since. We are not romantically involved. I think ever since that first day on that playground, we noticed something deviant in each other. And so we moved to New York together after college. We still share an apartment. And if you had asked Tate in high school, what do you want to be when you grow up? He would have said, I want to make movies. And if you had asked me, I would have said, I want to be a writer. So he, after that, moved on to L.A. to try to break into the movie business. And I was in New York getting, you know, rejection after rejection. His were doors slamming in his face. And we were going through this at the same time on opposite ends of America. And Tate, over, you know, about, I don't know, 10 or 12 years, he made one short film, and he made one full feature film that I believe grossed $8,000 in the box office. So when I found out the book was going to be published, Tate called me and said, can I have the rights to the book? And so, you know, I said, no. Had some cocktails, and he explained it to me like this. He said, if you don't let a Mississippian have the rights, then someone from Hollywood is going to take this story and completely glamorize it and turn it into some kind of Disneyland happy ending, you know, just Hollywood cliche. And everybody in my life was telling me, don't give the rights to Tate. I mean, my God, are you crazy? And I did. And so he took a year of his life and wrote an incredible screenplay. And then his phone did not ring. And we waited 3 months, nothing. And then one day his phone did finally ring, and it was Steven Spielberg. And he said, "Tate, let's make a movie." So I had a ball this summer. We made it in Greenwood, Mississippi, where it was literally 115 degrees with mosquitoes the size of house cats. And I sat there on set while Tate directed, and, you know, he was the writer and the director, and I didn't have a thing of responsibility. I shot spitballs at the back of his head, and after they'd finished shooting at 12 o'clock at night, we'd all go skinny dipping and drink bourbon, and it was fun. It's Emma Stone plays Skeeter. She's that little redhead in Easy A. And our friend Allison Janney plays Charlotte Phelan, that Skeeter's mother. Oh, and my friend, Octavia Spencer. I mean, she's amazing. She plays Minnie, and Viola Davis is gonna just steal your heart. She plays Abilene. Celia Foote, Cecily Tyson, sorry, plays Constantine. Sissy Spacek plays Mrs. Walters, who is kind of crazy in the book, you know, kind of senile, but she's batshit crazy in the movie. She's really great. It's fun when your friend is in charge of the movie because you get to put all your friends and family in it. I mean, Octavia lives with Tate in L.A., and my daughter was young Skeeter. She's 8, and she did not have a line or even a close-up. And she showed up on that set and said, "Where's my trailer?" So I'm excited. I hope y'all go see it. It comes out August 12th. Yes, ma'am.
I'm just wondering.
Oh, sorry. You got to take the mic.
Why do you think the book was turned down 50 times? Was it a politically correct thing, or was it a writing thing, or why?
Why was the book turned down 50 times? There are a lot of reasons. I'll tell you what I think. The worst thing that could happen to a first-time writer is for the first agent they mail a letter to accept them. Because every time I got a rejection letter, I went back to the story and revisited what's working, what's not working. And it forces you to re-examine your work over and over and over again. I mean, the first rejection letter, I was actually kind of excited because I felt like I had joined that club, you know, of rejection. And like 10 or 15, I still wanted to keep trying. And, you know, 35, 40, 50, 60. 61 was the one that took me. I think she truly felt sorry for me. And, you know, I don't know why she, but she was able to sell it in a couple of weeks to Amy Einhorn. So I think it's important. You know, with a group of this size, I know there've got to be a lot of writers out there. Please don't give up. I can guarantee you will not get published if you put that manuscript or voice or song, you know, in the coffin that is your bedside drawer and never open it again. If you keep trying, trust your instincts. You know, maybe 61 is your number two. Thank you. Yes, ma'am.
This is just an observation. I grew up on the main line of Philadelphia, a family of 9 children. And we always had our maid, and your book just rung such a wonderful note in me because we had our Doretha, who raised the younger part of my siblings, then came to work for me, raised all my 5 children, and everything that was in that book was just and the black, the language that you used, I just loved every bit of it. It just rang so true, and I know that to this day, Doretha calls me up, because she's now retired. We had a big retirement party for her. She calls me up. She says, Barbara, she says, I just dreamt about fish last night. And she says, I want to know who's pregnant. And I says, when she dreams about fish, somebody's pregnant. But we have a true love affair. And we visit with each other. And I realize I do still have that opportunity to get into her mind and really talk to her about those things that you wish that you had been able to have that conversation about. So it's not just in the South, you know. This was Philadelphia Main Line, same experience.
Thank you for sharing that.
I'd like to say that I've been married to this woman for 46 years, and I've never seen her read a book twice until this one.
Too. I get a lot of those. Thank you. Okay, sorry, I want to get to you.
I really enjoyed the audio version of the book, and I was wondering if you had any influence in the talent that performed. I know Octavia Spencer.
Yeah, Octavia reads The Voice of Many. When I was first, you know, about to go on tour, my publicist called me right when the book came out. She said, we are going to send you to two cities, Jackson and Memphis. And I thought, okay, I can handle that. And then she called me a couple of weeks later and said, we kind of changed our approach here. We're going to send you to 24 cities. And I panicked. I mean, all I could think about was how awful it would be for me to walk around America and read. I mean, I know I wrote a book in The Voice of African Americans, but just to actually have to face people and look them in the eye and read out loud. And so I called Octavia and I said, oh, please, will you come with me? I mean, that was just so incredible of her. She went around America with me and read in the voice of many and Abilene while I, you know, read in the white voices. And so then when the audio came along, I said, you have to do the audio. And so she did it, and she called me. She goes, I'm never doing that again. She was so mad at me. But I've heard it's good. I hadn't listened to it. Oh, thanks. I'm a little tired of the story, but maybe one day I'll hear it just because I want to celebrate Octavia. Thank you. Anna. Yes, ma'am.
Hi. Can I tell you, I liked Miss Celia. She was ditzy, but that was a story all unto itself. I just didn't get the man exposing himself.
Yeah, my publisher didn't either. My publisher asked me to take that out, and I thought about it, and I almost did, and I know that I knew that I probably should, but here's the thing. I could not come up with something else to bring Minnie and Celia together and have a role reversal where Celia was actually defending Minnie. I don't know. I guess my brain just was empty by that point. It was one of the last things I wrote. So, I might put a naked man in every book I write at this point just because I've run out of ideas. So you're not alone in that. Thank you. Yes, ma'am?
When your characters, their stories at the end of your book, they aren't complete, like Skeeter's going on to the rest of her life. Do you have the idea of what's going to become of your characters, even if it's not in the story?
I had to rewrite that ending several times because there was this expectation that there would be a bigger ending and something a little more final, something happier. But I did not think I would be telling the truth if I turned the ending into, you know, a so-called, you know, big birthday party, you know, Abilene wins the lottery and Minnie has the best job of her life. I mean, it was 1965 in Mississippi, and I just knew that Skeeter could run away from New York and And when she did that, she left Abilene and Minnie with a shitload of problems. And I didn't think it was realistic to downplay that, you know? I just wanted to make it clear that they are going to have to walk out the door and continue living their lives until things actually change in the homes of Mississippi. And that was not going to be anytime soon. And in some homes, it still hasn't happened. So I don't know what happens to these people afterwards. I think people ask me if I'm going to write a sequel, and I'm just not that interested in the 70s in Mississippi. It's just such a not a very attractive time. And I like to think about the 20s and 30s and 40s and 50s and what happened to these characters before they walk into the pages of The Help. So if I ever go back to these characters, I think I might go back there. Thank you. Yes, sir.
A quick comment. The woman was saying over there, you brought back memories because back 50 years ago, the family that I am with, we had a black maid for about 5 years, so the memories were really great. Because this woman was so thoughtful, so helpful. It was part of my childhood, and it really, really brought back good memories. Thank you.
Thank you. Not everybody had bad relationships. Not everybody had good relationships. I wanted to really juxtapose Minnie with her families and Abilene with her families. I mean, it was different in every household, so thank you. Yes? I can't see. Oh, yes, sure.
Actually, I'm going to pass the mic to a lady over there.
Okay. Okay.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you for coming. And I just wanted to say whether you intended to teach a lesson or not, you really did. And for me, it was that it had nothing to do with race, but that more that when you're interested in another person, when you love another person, then you can walk in their shoes and speak with their voice. So thank you. It was very, very touching. I read it in like a day and a half. And I was mad that I had to go to work and interrupt my flow. But I wanted to ask you, what would you say is like the best compliment or conversation that's been started with you about the book?
Oh, wow. I have never been asked that question. And you know, Andy asked me if I ever get a new question. So I said, no, I really don't. The best compliment probably came last night from an African-American woman who accused me of basically plagiarizing her story, another black woman's story. She was saying it very nicely, but she was saying, look, I just don't understand how you wrote in the black voices. How did you get that language that way? And she said, and I'm black and you are not. And it was funny, and there was a lot of love in the question and in the comment. And I thought, wow, because I know, look, I know I've said it 3 times on the podium. I know I didn't get it all right. I cringe when I think about what I've done. But that one just, that made me feel good that someone could maybe hear their own voice in a voice that I just made up. So thank you for that original question. Okay, somebody's just going to have to holler because I can't see who to call in.
Hi, thank you for coming. I wanted to ask, was there anything that was edited out of the book that you wish had gotten into the book?
Well, I mean, that naked man was supposed to be taken out, and I didn't let it go. I had a scene where Minnie actually gets quite serious when Leroy is beating the shit out of her, and Kendra's driving her crazy, and Celia Foote's just dumb as a stick. And I had her really have a talk with herself where she's, you know, it's not funny. She's not joking around. She's not doing all that. She's having a real sit down with herself and asking herself, where is my life going? Who am I? And we took it out because it was a little bit too obvious, and they felt like it wasn't quite in her character. So I don't know if I wish it was in there or not, but as a writer, I think you have to overwrite inner conversations that characters have, you know, with themselves to understand better who they are and where push them to the very limit, to where they are just desperate and asking themselves questions that they haven't asked themselves before. And that said, you know, I loved irritating Minnie. I populated her entire world with people just to piss her off. I love her. I see a lot of myself in her. And, you know, Kendra's hollering. And so, yeah, I really wanted to push her as hard as I could and yet not break her. So thank you.
I wonder what happens when you go home again. I mean, Atlanta in the 21st century is hardly Jackson in the 1960s, and I know you're writing it from here, but to go back to Jackson or to the towns, you people you grew up with, even 50 years later, what happens?
Well, I just keep telling them it's fiction. Some people don't like the book in Mississippi. Some people don't like the book in North Dakota. I mean, it's, you know, the opinions vary so much. I mean, I don't think the junior league's real pleased with me at this point. But they've actually been very gracious. And, you know, sometimes I'll tour in Mississippi or I'll go to a bookstore and someone will say, "Oh, I just loved your story." Of course, I never was that way. So I just nod and smile. There are some people that don't want to go back to that time because they're embarrassed or ashamed or they're just ready to move on, and I totally get that. I mean, I've been on tour for 2 years, and I'm ready to move on. Not really. I'm glad to be here. I love y'all. I just don't really like, you know, people. So, you know, I'm very grateful that my family has stuck by me the way they have. So, thank you. Yes, ma'am.
Thank you. Can you talk a little more about the writing process? You touched on it with the symbolism about the keys, but what do you do if you get writer's block? Help us with some of that.
I usually just give up. It's writer's block, I think, can be cured by one thing and one thing only, and that is reading. And, you know, it doesn't mean you have to search for the right book to read, but just take your favorite book, open it up in the middle, and just start reading again. And I find after that my fingers get so hungry to start typing again, and I get so pissed off that someone wrote this incredible book that I'm reading that I want to go back and start working on mine again. That's the only solution I have. Oh, wait, there's one more. I think it's really important to have a great mentor, and I found mine. I actually had more trouble finding my mentor than I did my husband. It's hard to find the right fit as a writer. Mine was Alexandra Shelley. She's incredible. She tells me oh so gently when something is not working. And at the same time, you know, praises me if something is working. But, you know, she doesn't do it for free. I pay her. And she's amazing. Her number's on my website. If any, you know, if you find that she's the one for you, then great. Thank you. All right. Okay. Yes, ma'am.
You mentioned to begin with that you'd never intended to have the book published. You were writing because you were homesick, and you were kind of writing for yourself. Now you've been published, you've been extremely successful, your next book is coming up. Do you find that you're writing that differently because you've had people talk about your writing style, you've had rejections, you've had acceptance, you've had a movie. Do you think that's going to influence the way that you look at your second book?
Yes. You know, it's funny to say that I didn't really think it was going to be published. I was just writing for myself. And then to reveal that I actually got turned down by 60 agents. I cannot say what it is about a writer. Because, you know, writers, like I said, we don't really like people. And we don't really think that it's... I don't know. We like to write in our little rooms and keep our door closed. And I don't know why we want to be published. It's the craziest thing. It's such a dichotomy in our personality. So I sent out my first letter because my writing teacher made me. But just that big no, big fat rejection on that letter just kind of made me wanted to keep trying. And I'm so, you know, some people call it tenacity. You ask my husband, it's called stubborn. And hell yeah, it's affecting the way I write now. Every time I go in my office, you know, y'all are all in there staring at me. And all I can think is, please, just leave me alone. Let me just write. And yet at the same time, every time I go out on the road, I just fall in love with every town, every audience. So I really mean that. I don't like people, but I really like y'all. So thank you. I'm terrified, obviously. So, two more questions. Does anybody have any left? What has not been asked? Let's see. You already asked a question.
Hi, I have a question. First of all, don't apologize for your book ever. It was amazing. It was a book that people woke up at 8 a.m. to finish reading and then called their friend. My question is, I bought the book, The Postmistress, because you wrote a little thing on the front that said how great it was. Does that ring a bell with you? Because I thought it sucked.
Of course, I love The Postmistress.
Really? I want to know why you liked it, because the characters in it were so unauthentic. I thought that the main character, Frankie, the war correspondent, was terribly untrue. And I want to know what writers and books do you like now?
Okay, well, I love The Postmistress. I thought it was beautiful and just an incredible journey. I was fascinated with that old, you know, she didn't have a tape recorder during World War II. So she has this old, you know, it was like an old record player, and she would put the needle down, and it would actually record on a record people's voices and their stories. The books that I love, I am reading The Paris Wife right now. I just think it's incredible. The Paris Wife, I just finished Unbroken. I am so damn mad I did not write that book. I think Ellen Hillenbrand literally is the best nonfiction writer in America. Incredible. She wrote Seabiscuit. It will blow your mind. So Unbroken. My favorite book of all time is Lolita. Because, you know, how did he pull that off? The Liars Club, Mary Carr. Oh, that was such a good one. Donna Tartt, The Secret History. I don't know. I really think writing is 10 times harder for me than it is all those other writers out there. I think they own some kind of devil's pen, you know, where the words just flow out and they're just born with it, you know, like blue eyes or money. I wish I had it. All right, one more question.
Do you still have a question?
The thing that I loved about it was that you seemed to have the kind of courage to do the things that I have wished in my head that I had done. I mean, the toilet seats on the lawn were just brilliant. The cake, the chocolate cake. I mean, these are the kinds of things I just think about. Do you just think about them, or do you just put them in your book?
I just make the shit up. One more. Let's take one more. Thank you. Sorry I didn't have a better answer for you.
I really loved the book. It was really outstanding. If someone had a great story and it wasn't your original story, would you be willing to write that story if they were able to convey this great story to you? Would it be interesting?
No.
No?
I'm sorry. I'm being cheeky. You know, I wish I could do that. I wish I could write a story that isn't my own, but... There we go. Exit right. I wish I could. And all I'm stuck with are the demons inside my own head. But thank you. I hope you'll go to your typewriter and write your story. You never know what's inside of you. Thank you. I hope y'all enjoy it.
Finish it one.
Thank you.
She looked like the winning horse at the Kentucky Derby.
I have drafted the Home Health Sanitation Initiative.
The what?
A bill that requires every white home to have a separate bathroom for the health.
Maybe we should just build you a bathroom outside, Haley. White children. We love them and they love us, but they can't even use the toilets in our houses.
Minnie, are you in there?
You are fired!
You said to write about what disturbs me, particularly if it bothers no one else.
I'd like to write something from the point of view of the help.
I want to interview you.
No maid is ever going to tell you the truth. That's a hell of a risk to take in Jackson, Mississippi.
Courage! Isn't just about being brave. It's about overcoming fear and daring to do what is right for your fellow man.
What changed your mind?
God. And Miss Hilly Holbrook.
I'm gonna help with your stories. We all are.
Y'all brought me into this, but I'm gonna finish it.
Have you lost your mind?
No, ma'am. But you about to.
Quite scandalous. Sounds like Jackson, if you ask me.
You tell Avery, do I have plans for her?
You are godless, woman. We've gone done it now.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.